I have the great privilege now of introducing my first guest of the day, which is Stephanie Buckland, author of How I Said Bar to Cancer. Good afternoon.
Hello, thank you for having me.
Thank you very much for coming in. So Stephanie is here to promote her new book, which came out last week, a couple of weeks ago, something along those lines?
The beginning of October, yes.
Beginning of October. So first and most obvious question, you're a cancer survivor, and a lot of people who have beaten cancer have not to put too fine a point on it, not felt the pressing need to write a book. So what was it about your experience that prompted you to do this?
That's a really good question. When you're diagnosed with cancer, you're thrown into a world where the physical is king. It's as though a little bit of your body has turned against you, and everyone becomes very interested in that part of you. They poke at the product, they test it, they irradiate it, they do all sorts of things to it. And, you know, that's absolutely necessary. But my background when I'm not writing is that I train in thinking skills. So I had a very clear understanding that how you think about things has a big impact on the way that you deal with them. And when I was diagnosed with cancer, I waited for somebody to talk to me about how to think about it, not in a sort of, ooh, be positive way, which is very actually unhelpful, I think, but just in terms of thinking strategies and ways to look at cancer. And nobody did. And I just thought, well, actually, maybe there needs to be a book about this. You're stuck with what happens to you physically, by and large, with cancer, but you have control over how you think about it, and this book is meant to help you to control that thinking process.
So it's sort of therapy for the mind, as a sort of complement to the course of drugs that you might have to go through.
Yeah, absolutely. It's a kind of handbook for coping with the mental side of cancer, if you like.
Great. So take us back to the moment when you first found out that you had breast cancer. What was going through your mind? Were you angry? Were you afraid? Did you feel despairing? You know, sort of, why me? What exactly went through in those first sort of few hours or couple of days?
I've been thinking about this a lot because it's actually 3 years tomorrow since I got the diagnosis. By the time I got to the meeting in the hospital with the folder on the desk and the tissues, I kind of knew what was coming because I'd had several weeks' worth of tests with bigger and bigger needles and more anaesthetic and people being nicer and nicer to me. So I sort of knew what was coming, but I think I still felt, well, I don't think this is quite right. I don't think this is quite fair. I was only 37, which is very young for breast cancer. There was no history of breast cancer in the family, and it just seemed sort of wrong. I didn't have time to have cancer, and I was and I really couldn't be bothered. And so I was kind of annoyed, I think, as much as anything else. And then I was very lucky in that I was told almost immediately, you know, yes, you have cancer, and obviously that's not great, but what is great is that we've caught it at a very early stage. So I think knowing that nobody was expecting me to die of it, knowing that, you know, there wasn't any terrible, terrible news, kind of made me feel quite positive in that if I had to have a cancer diagnosis, I kind of felt so I'd got the best one.
Yeah, because for people who aren't in the know, and you go into this in the book, there's four stages of cancer that you can be diagnosed with. I think there's a line in the book where you say stage one is very positive, and stage four means don't go around buying anything with the word durable on it.
Exactly, yes.
Perhaps not when you were first diagnosed, but do you find now that you can treat the subject of your cancer specifically and cancer in general with a certain amount of irreverence?
Yes, I think I can, and I think most people do. You know, there are a lot of oncologist jokes doing the rounds quietly of waiting rooms. And
care to treat us to one?
Okay, I will. Why are coffin lids nailed down?
No idea.
To stop the oncologist getting in to give you one more dose of chemotherapy, just in case. you know, people laugh in the face of all sorts of disasters, and I think the same is true of cancer. The other thing is that even when cancer is going on, you know, life doesn't stop. Your godchildren still say funny things. You can still watch a film that makes you laugh. So, so you know, all of those kind of fun things about life are happening at the same time.
Yeah. There's a line in the book where you say, it's how I think about life, not life itself, that can make me feel happy or wretched. So relative to all the treatments you're getting in terms of actual, you know, radiotherapy and chemotherapy and the support of your family and the various, you know, armies of doctors, how important is willpower compared to all of that?
I don't think that the way that you think can cure you of cancer. I think, you know, there are books, there are people on the kind of fringes of the cancer camp who think, well, you know, if you eat certain vitamins and think about sunshine, then, you know, then you'll somehow be all right.
I think.
Yeah. And I don't know. There is a lot of anecdotal evidence that says that's possible. I kind of think you know you need the big guns, you need the chemotherapy and the surgery and the radiotherapy and all the nasty stuff, but you can choose to think about it in a different way, and that in itself can make you feel better. For example, I always tried to think of chemotherapy, which is, you know, which is essentially a poison, but I tried to think of it as a sort of as bags of light that were being kind of dispensed into my body and running through my veins and illuminating me and kind of making the disease sort of explode away in fireworks. And it sounds silly, but it's a lot nicer to sit in a chair for 3 hours thinking about that happening to your body than thinking about something kind of poisonous and noxious that's essentially kind of killing as much as it cures. So
it's not denial exactly. It's
no,
sort of
no, not at
a
all.
Positive spin on.
Exactly, and it's. I think it's about a positive approach rather than positive thinking. When people talk about positive thinking, very often what they want you to do is just pretend to be happy if you're not, which doesn't help anybody. Yeah. So, no, I think it's about a positive approach. So it's about saying, well, okay, I feel wretched, I feel miserable. What can I do to help myself? Well, you know, why don't I have a bath? Why don't I call my mum? Why don't I ring my oncologist and say, is it normal to be feeling these symptoms at this time? So, yeah, it's very much, I think, about being practical and as a way of being positive, which also includes allowing yourself to feel miserable, you know, if that's how you're feeling.
What I was going to say when we were talking about it in terms of reverence, do you think it's a particularly northeastern thing or a typically British thing to take that sort of attitude?
I don't know. I do have a lot of kind of followers and correspondents who are American, and they do tend to find they're so amused by me, whereas British people kind of tend to kind of go, oh, well, you know, good for you, that's terrific, and it's sort of less out of the ordinary. But yeah, I certainly feel that in terms of being in the Northeast, people kind of look at the approach and accept it. You know, they don't kind of go, oh, that's very strange or weird or odd. They just kind of go, well, you know, yeah, great, I can see that, good for you, which is lovely.
Yeah. The foreword to your book is written by Edward de Bono.
Yes.
I was wondering if you could elaborate on your connection with him and his methods, because many people will know him as, correct me if I'm wrong, but the inventor of lateral thinking.
You're absolutely right. Yes, Dr. Edward de Bono is the world's leading authority on the teaching of thinking as a skill. So that's learning to think separately from whatever it is that you're thinking about. And it, in my day job, if you like, when I'm not writing, that's what I do. I train people to think differently. I train them in lateral thinking skills. I train them in thinking more effectively as individuals and as groups. And really the fact that I did this was what made me realise that I could think about cancer differently as well. So when I started to write the book, I contacted Dr. de Bono, who I had met on a couple of occasions, and asked him, you know, whether he might say something nice about it, and he very generously wrote a foreword.
At this point, I think it would benefit our listeners who are sort of getting intrigued by all of this if you were to read a short passage from your book. This is from How I Said Bar to Cancer, from page 28, and describes your battle with cancer as a dance. So if you could read the passage, and then we'll talk about it a little bit.
Of course. Because I thought of myself as dancing with cancer, it made sense to see cancer as a dance partner. I didn't see it as being a dashing, may I have this dance, twinkle in the eye, steer you around the floor so you feel as though you're flying partner, though. Oh, no. The cancer I was dancing with was pockmarked and clumsy, with bad breath and a grip I couldn't wriggle out of. I had no respect for this partner, and I knew that the minute the music stopped playing, I would wrench myself free and walk away without a backward glance.
Fantastic. So, in terms of that analogy, because what you were saying before about sort of thinking of chemotherapy in terms of these great fireworks going off around your body, are analogies like that, are they a coping mechanism, or is thinking about cancer in that way something that came to you after your course of treatment was over, or is that how you saw it when all of that was going on?
The whole idea of dancing with cancer came to me quite early on, because people immediately kind of drop into battle analogies, you know, you'll fight this and you'll win and you'll beat it. And although I can really understand why, if you're not an aggressive person and if you're already feeling kind of slightly run over by the whole cancer diagnosis, then people telling you to fight can feel very uncomfortable, particularly because, you know, we know what battlefields are like. They're strewn with dead bodies. And so for me, thinking about battling wasn't a kind of good thought. So I thought, well, I need a different way to think about this. So I decided that I would think about dancing with cancer, largely because nobody dies of dancing.
And also because I suppose it fits in with the comment that you made about you may have cancer, but the rest of your life goes on, and dancing is something that you would do regardless of whether you had cancer or not. So it's just another part of your life rather than your life has become defined by your illness.
Exactly, exactly so.
Yeah. Do you think, I mean, there's a lot of money going into cancer charities and cancer research in the last 10 years or so, but do you think there's still any sort of social stigma about either cancer itself or cancer patients in terms of are people still afraid to talk about it, or is there a lack of understanding?
I think a lot of people have sort of previous with cancer, if you like. They have bad experience. They lost a mother or a sister or a father or a grandfather. So I think that there is always that kind of feeling of shock and horror. I think breast cancer is not particularly stigmatized, but other cancers are. I have a relative who had lung cancer, and although she had never smoked in her life, she kind of felt that people reacted to her in a very kind of odd way because she had lung cancer, and sort of thought that somehow she'd brought it on herself. So I think there are some cancers that are still stigmatized, but I think the sheer volume of people who are affected by cancer means that it is becoming, I suppose, more every day, sadly.
Yeah, because the statistic that's battered around is that 1 in 3 people will be affected by cancer directly over the course of their life. I don't know how accurate that is at the moment.
Yes, I think that's about it. Yes.
Yeah. You've provided a lot of helpful, because you described the book as a handbook very much rather than just an account, whole sections of it are set out like a blog. In particular, there's a lot of helpful lists of questions to ask about sort of chemo and radiotherapy. You sort of list a few sort of things that you ask if you'll have to undergo a course of those.
Yeah, I think what very often happens is because hospitals are pushed for time and sort of energy, I suppose, positive energy from clinicians, then you very often get told this is what's going to happen and this is how we're going to do it. And I think it can be worth just kind of stopping and finding out why exactly things are being done in the way that they're being done. So I think it's always helpful to ask questions like, if I was being treated in another hospital, would I be offered the same treatment? Is the reason that this is urgent to do with what's happening in my body, or is it to do with what the hospital targets are? What will happen to me as a result of this treatment? What are the long-term effects of this treatment? Can I talk to somebody else who is undergoing this treatment at the moment? And you know, you get some interesting answers. When I was having radiotherapy, I was also working. I'm self-employed, so you know, it was kind of critical that I did. And the hospital were fairly unsympathetic. You know, when I say, oh, I can't come in on Wednesday, or I'll need to come in very early on Thursday, and they would kind of say, well, it's critically important that you have this treatment. And I'd say, okay, in that case, would you like me to come in on Saturday or Sunday? And they'd kind of go, oh, no, that won't be necessary. So, you know, I think you can ask questions about, you know, if it's so critical that I have radiotherapy every day, why aren't we coming in on Bank Holiday Monday?
On Christmas Day.
Yes, exactly.
Yeah, I mean, I suppose a lot of these questions are for your peace of mind as much as anything else, because you, although there is an instinct to trust medical professionals when you're that ill,
yes,
you want to know that you're being treated properly and as quickly as possible.
Yes, you do, and I think also you want to feel that you're being treated as an individual as well. You know, there are standard treatments that work for most people, and that's absolutely fine. But if you're struggling with treatment, I think, you know, you're within your rights to just ask some questions. For example, I was particularly ill after my fifth round of chemotherapy, and I went back to my surgeon and said, you know, I'm really worried about having this final treatment because I'm feeling absolutely terrible. And he said, oh, well, you know, actually, he kind of looked at the statistics, and he looked at what I was being treated with, and he said, you will have had 90% of the benefits that you're going to get from this treatment from the first two chemotherapy rounds of chemotherapy that you've had, and you know the last one has almost a negligible effect. And I kind of thought, you know, if I hadn't asked that question, then I would be looking at another month of being probably quite seriously ill.
So is six rounds a sort of fairly average dose in terms of how much chemotherapy you have?
Yes.
Does it vary with the cancer?
It varies with the cancer and it varies with the treatment, but it's not unusual. The type of chemotherapy I had, I think every dose kills 90% of any cancers that are there. So if you have six, then you know, yeah. You've pretty much cleaned up.
Yeah, and in terms of the side effects of therapy, did you have sort of hair loss or, like you say, feeling very ill for long periods of time? Just talk us through that.
Yes, when I had chemotherapy, I lost my hair. I had quite big sort of digestive problems. What I didn't realise about chemotherapy is that it basically kills all fast-growing cells in your body, because cancer is a fast-growing cell.
Including
so that's what it's decided to do. Yeah, but that also means that all of the gut bacteria, right from your mouth, right the way through your system, goes. So eating became very difficult. I had all sorts of problems with, you know, heartburn, which is fantastically underrated as an ailment. I couldn't sleep. I had problems with my joints. I had problems with my heart. I had problems with breathing. So, you know, I kind of felt like a bit of a wreck. Yeah. But, you know, it did all pass.
And how long did it take to recover those functions? So I was doing some research the other day. I'm a big cricketing fan. And Geoffrey Boycott, when he got throat cancer in 2003, had to effectively live off liquefied food for 12 months because his saliva glands had been really packed up. So how long did it take your body to sort of get over chemotherapy?
I think it probably took a good four or five months before I kind of felt like not the walking dead again.
Having cancer is deeply traumatic for the sufferer, or to use your word, the dancer. But what about the effect that it must have on the partner or the family involved? I mean, when you had to tell your partner or your close friends, what kind of reactions did you get?
Yeah, no, I've maintained all along that it's horrible to have cancer, but it really must be worse to watch somebody that you love have it. I was very, very lucky in that everyone around me has been amazingly supportive and helpful. What I decided to do was I decided to try and show them how I wanted to be treated. So when I told people that I'd had the diagnosis, I also told them that, you know, I was going to very much try to treat this as just a part of life, and very much try to have kind of life as normal. And I asked them to help me to do that by, you know, not thinking, oh, we won't invite her to go to this because she probably won't feel up to it. And I really kind of invited everyone to keep me involved in life as it went on. And that's what they did, which is brilliant.
Just one last question to round up, and I found the book very helpful. Just, you know, it was in a very emotional read in the best possible way, and there'll be a lot of people out there listening who may be affected with cancer, either directly because they're suffering from it or indirectly because they, you know, and like you said, love someone who is. The book's full of helpful advice, but what one tip would you give for people out there who are suffering in whatever respect?
Just take a deep breath and remember that cancer does not define you. It's a part of your life, but it will never be all of your life.
Fantastic. Well, thank you very much, Stephanie Butland, for coming in. Her book is called How I Said Bar to Cancer, which is available now at all good bookshops and online. Thank you very much again for coming in. It's been a pleasure to talk to you.
It's been lovely. Thank you. Thank you.